Hello everyone and welcome to the Monday edition of the Daily Friend. I'm your host Nicholas Lorimer and I'm joined by two of my fun and fabulous colleagues here, Mr. Gabriel Krauser.
Greetings and salutations.
And Mr. Herman Pretorius.
Salutations and greetings.
Brilliant. Wow, we didn't even rehearse that. That's fantastic. So let's get right into
it. Monday, we're nice and fresh.
Get it right into the hot.
It's Monday, we're fresh and nice.
Okay, let's not.
We're going to have to start this again if we don't get into the news.
So let's jump right into the exciting news. And the first one is that our great president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has a new driver.
Mm.
Gabriel, who is it? I've seen his face before. Didn't he win something?
Yeah, so he won the Nobel Prize,
okay.
Ramaphosa's driver.
It's the kind of drivers that you can afford in South Africa, apparently.
Yeah. Well, this wasn't in South Africa. This was in Addis Ababa.
In Addis Ababa.
President Ramaphosa flew over there, and instead of getting a sort of blue light cavalcade to drive him through, he was picked up directly by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. And the photo that was taken of the two of them driving down the sort of main boulevard was on the front page of the Sunday Times, I think, was really telling. Ramaphosa looks jejune. He's sweating. He's sort of laughing a little bit too hard, whereas Ahmed looks slightly naughty, but really like he's won something. And I think what he's won is a little moment of PR coup, a little PR glory.
I can't think of anything where someone gets showed up more than the fact that a country like Ethiopia, a country not known for its democratic institutions, a country not known for its lack of corruption,
yeah,
is showing us up,
yeah,
at the PR game.
Yeah. And it's PR management is supposed to be Ramaphosa's great forte.
I think it's also good for Ramaphosa to see what an actual reformer looks like. So
yeah.
The Prime Minister of Ethiopia the reason he won the Nobel Prize is because he has done a lot to change Ethiopia. Ethiopia is still a very, what we might call, a depressed place.
Yeah, it's very well. It's still economically growing very fast.
Still politically quite unfree.
Yeah, Ahmed's keystone achievement is making peace with Eritrea. Mm. There's been a lot of tensions there,
and that's quite a long war. It started in the 90s, I think.
Yeah. At least, yeah. So let's just give a quick breakdown of Ethiopia for listeners who maybe have heard about this Nobel Prize, but aren't super familiar with what's going on there. So Ethiopia, much like South Africa, much like Italy, Germany, much like many nation states that we think of today as having been around forever, was really forged in the 19th century under the pressures of international conflict, bringing together disparate tribes with different language groups, different cultural identities. You might call them racial identities or ethnic identities because they're grounded in myths or realities of shared ancestry, and sort of by coalescing around a common enemy and common interest in gaining access to coastal port trading zones so that they can get economic development, you get a single nation forged. One of the upshots of that is that the Amharas, you're going to have to forgive me for butchering some of this pronunciation, is a minority group, 20 million at the moment out of 100 million. But they ruled Ethiopia through a monarchy basically from the 19th century through to 1974, when Haile Selassie, the last great emperor of Ethiopia, was toppled by a communist revolution. And he really did a super great job of being, in many ways, the poster boy for African independence. Ethiopia was relatively stable compared to a lot of African countries in the sort of period after World War II, when there was mass decolonization starting in Ghana. Ethiopia hadn't been colonized properly. It sort of had beaten back the Italians.
Mm. It was only under Italian occupation for a few years.
Yeah. Mm. So they had this sort of proud legacy of that, and also the greater levels of stability.
Which is why the African Union headquarters is in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia.
Yeah, precisely. So the OAU before the AU was grounded there. And also just an interesting sort of note in history is that after World War II, the arguments for constitutional monarchies or monarchies generally was given a second wind by so much of the instability in the younger democracies, for example, the Weimar Republic. You know, when Germany got rid of its monarchy and became a so-called democracy, it ended up producing Nazis, and people were worried about the same thing happening in Africa. And in fact, there really was some brutal stuff going on. Everyone remembers the cannibal and torturer leader of Uganda. So Ethiopia was looking good. At the same time, Haile Selassie just basically allowed corporate interests and big government to get very cozy in a very nasty way and produced what's now known as the Green Famine, because Ethiopia is a country a lot like South Africa. A lot of pastoral lands, beautiful for farming, especially if you can irrigate.
Yeah, but quite dry. Yeah.
So you've got to manage it properly. Anyway, huge food producer, actually. It's not just all desert.
And they also have a history of ethnic tension.
So between the ethnic tension and the sort of economic malaise under this fabulous poster boy, Haile Selassie, of stability and compromise and being a kind of bring everyone together kind of person, you had the Green Famine, where this very green country was producing enough food to feed itself but not really getting it to the people, and so there was mass starvation, and there would have been many, many more millions dying if it weren't for international intervention. Selassie then gets undone, and the Tigrayans, it's an even smaller ethnic group, then take charge. Tigrayans are maybe 6% of the population, and they run the country for the next couple of decades. They then get displaced themselves and sort of then regain power, and they were sort of in charge, sort of constituted most of the political elite until a couple of years ago. Now, the Oromo are the largest minority in Ethiopia, roughly 30%, 30 million people, and they've never been in charge since there was an Ethiopia. They were under the Amharas, sort of aristocratic class, then under the Tigrayans, the new sort of more Soviet aristocratic workers, elite class. And what you have in Abiy Ahmed is someone who's half Oromo and half Tigray and half Amhara. So the two largest minorities, one of which has totally been shunted from power for the longest time, and so they've been very excited.
And he's used his background to kind of unite the nation,
to talk a story of, you know, mom and dad come from different, you know, we can all come together as I physically embody. That's excited a lot of Oromo political energy, and some of that's played out well, some of it's played out quite disturbingly. A bit of Oromo race nationalism, and so there's been, in lieu of the tensions, there've been 3 million people displaced under Abiy Ahmed's reign, but just for a year and a half.
But at the same time, there's been releasing of lots of political prisoners, I believe.
So it's precisely because of that reform, and so what's exciting, what he gets that we don't get, is that there's no such thing as a free lunch. If you've got a screwed up system, which Ethiopia very much had, you can't go from that to a healthy system without there being some problems. And so freeing the journalists, freeing
political prisoners. They've sold off a lot of state-owned enterprises as well.
And yeah. I must say, it has had short-term negative consequences, but it puts them on the long-term track for growth, both economically and in terms of freedom.
But I must say one thing, that there's a lot that our president can learn from the Prime Minister of Ethiopia. But one of the things that I think quite remarkable is, in an interview with the Financial Times last year, the Prime Minister said that he doesn't really care that much about the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, his party, the EPRDF. But he doesn't think they'll split. But the sentiment is clearly that they'll probably get they'll go after his leadership. He'll lead them, and he doesn't think they'll split. And I think that's a very brave thing to take, is to say that you care more about your country's success than your party's unity. And that's something that I think Ramaphosa specifically can learn from in terms of politics.
And of course, perhaps in some ways, his signature achievement is, what has Ethiopia's growth rate been? It's been
7%. I think it's forecast to be 7%.
7-8%, yeah.
7-8%. And it hit, I think, a few years ago, 9 or 10%. It was the fastest growing economy in the world, I think, 2 or 3 years ago.
To be fair, they are starting from a very low base.
Yes, from a very low base. And they continue to be a country riven with a lot of problems. But I think they do provide, in many ways, a blueprint for what South Africa should be doing.
Yeah, so I remembered when this Sunday Times poster, and the lighting is so beautiful. There's this gold sheen on the not that fancy Mercedes that they're driving through. It looks like an old Mbenzi car in a way. Ahmed just looking so much more comfortable and in command than Ramaphosa, because he's being like Tito Mboweni with his old rubber shoes.
Exactly.
He's saying, you know, to be powerful, I don't have to jazz myself up and Gucci this. I can actually use my power to show that there's something potent in service, in being a driver.
And we have a strange thing in South Africa, where a lot of our ruling elite likes to swan around with these, you know, huge ranks of bodyguards
and the cavalcades
and massive convoys.
spending more on that than on land reform.
The prime, yeah, VIP protection, all of those cavalcades cost literally gets more budget than...
The prime minister of Ethiopia, I would say, is in far more danger of coup, assassination, all sorts of actual real dangers to his life. And here he is driving around our president.
Yeah. So the moment that it reminded me of was when Nelson Mandela was released in 1990, February, 20 years ago, roughly speaking, almost to the day.
Tomorrow, 20 years ago.
Until then, Robert Mugabe had been regularly described as the star, the bright African star, because Mugabe had run this revolution, he'd overseen a new democratic dispensation, he'd preserved property rights until then, he had bolstered the education system himself, he'd gotten many degrees while he'd been in prison.
Reconciliatory towards former oppressors.
Yeah. So he was the bright African star. And then the sun came out. That was the line. Mandela is the sun. To the star. And the point was that Mandela, what Mandela had that Mugabe lacked, amongst other things, was a very serious economy to run. Mm. And that star being sort of eclipsed by the true sun, I think really was a metaphor that gained traction when Mandela went to Switzerland, to Davos, to say, look, we have, the ANC was chased into the hands of the Soviets. I mean, he didn't say this, but he did say, we cannot run on a Soviet model. We cannot be thinking about nationalizing the land, the banks, the mines. We have to be pragmatists. We have to reconcile, not just ideologically, but we have to literally work together in order to make this work.
A much easier argument to make in the early 90s, although, of course, in that narrative you just spun of the way that people looked at Mugabe and Mandela, the other thing, of course, to always remember about that story is it's a lie about Mugabe because of how, you know, the Gukurahundi and the violence he committed. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm. Mugabe had already done one of his worst atrocities.
Yeah.
He had already allowed himself more or less proactively to rise to the top of ZANU-PF through assassinating political opponents.
So we had already gotten to a sort of false, it was already a storybook tale that was not really true.
Exactly. And so I think this analogy of our great star meeting a true sun of the African continent story.
Yes, no, very much so.
It's just a rhyme across time.
And I must say, the thing that really strikes me about it, and I might be a simpleton and a pleb, but I genuinely like politicians who do what they say on the tin, as it were. And it's difficult to say, to even understand what is in Ramaphosa's tin, but it's even more difficult what the tin says on the outside. Where
depends what angle you look at it from.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely exactly on the one side.
And depends on which shelf it currently is, you know, socializing with other tins. But Abiy says quite clearly in an interview, my model is capitalism.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, how beautiful is just such a simple statement to know where someone stands ideologically, what they want to do with the country.
Mm. Yeah. No, I think it gives hope for Africa, if not necessarily hope for South Africa. So I would like to move on to a wonderful thing that happened in here. Now, I know that Herman, you and Gabriel have been playing tennis recently, but we also had a big tennis event, did we not?
Yes, unrelated to what? To the Gabriel
the Gabriel Hadamon tennis.
That's not yet open to the public, but I'm sure it'll draw big crowds.
Yeah, we've had some interest, mostly from people telling us that the courts are now closed. we've had the Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal. What's it?
I mean, even someone who doesn't really understand tennis, I know those names. So you know that they're a big deal.
Yeah. So we had two of the big three old guard guys still playing tennis.
Mm.
Come to face each other off. And what's unique about this is that they played in the Cape, in the Greenside Cape Town soccer stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had the biggest live audience for a tennis match ever in the history of the world, because they were playing in a soccer stadium instead of a tennis court. They built a court there. And then there was a kind of exhibition doubles match after the singles with Bill Gates and Trevor Noah joining in. Federer and Nadal.
That's quite an exclusive club if the poorest of the four only has $28 million.
There we go. So, I think it is, okay, let's start out by saying, nice record to hold, world's biggest tennis match, nice to have America's great capitalist and two great tennis players and South Africa's comedian with the widest audience,
yes,
gather up in Cape Town and do this little exhibition. And they raise a lot of money for charity. That was the point of the event. So good on them for that. I think part... Okay, but if you dig a little bit deeper, there's some irritating points. One of them is that a lot of people sitting in row Z really couldn't see anything at all. It was kind of like buy the ticket to say you were there, because just tennis is the you know, there comes a point where the ball is so small and people are so far away that you can't see what's going on.
A soccer stadium is not the ideal.
Another thing is that they raised the pitch up a few meters, the court. So if you were had one of the expensive seats towards the front, you're kind of watching up the shorts and seeing the feet more than anything else of these tennis players. So it's like the front row is not that great either. Another thing is that the quality of the tennis was really poor. Federer won, but it looked like Nadal hadn't really phoned it in. He was really playing very poor tennis. Another thing is that the exhibition match, Trevor Noah was awful, hamming it up, kind of clearly hadn't practiced very hard to come into the thing. Bill Gates is a really old man. He seemed to be doing okay, but it's like kind of embarrassing that this 30-year-old dude can't really do anything. So like an element of farce, which I think we as South Africans are
very used to,
and a sense of how sad it is, a sense of the missed opportunity. Some of our colleagues, some of the people who work on the more businessy side of the IRRCRA stable are really obsessed with this notion of the great unseens that libertarian and Austrian economists frequently spoke to in the 20th century. One of the things you don't see is the missed opportunity, what you're not doing. Here's something that could have happened, that was widely discussed, that people were pushing for in the 90s and the 2000s when we really were economically growing. It was that South Africa should get a Grand Slam. Now, we already have the South African Open, which is basically a tournament as big as the names that you can draw into it. Why would you want to come and play in South Africa if you are Roger Federer? Well, if you're Roger Federer, it's kind of fun because you have some South African ancestry. I think his father was South African. But aside from that, you'd want to come and play in South Africa because everyone around the world, whether they're from Australia or Europe or America, has a soft spot for Africa. Right, so you get to Africa's Grand Slam. You can go and visit. It's the only continent that doesn't have a really large tennis tournament. So there's this. We're sort of boosting the continent. We're boosting this very important economy. You get to go visit. You encourage. One of the great things about it, you look at the Australian Open, you draw in thousands and thousands of really well endowed tourists that are then going to go to the Cape and to the Kruger and to the little fancy villages where there's like an artsy vibe.
Yeah.
We don't have that, and the reason we don't have it is because our sports bodies weren't good enough at negotiating the complicated things that go around it, the television broadcasting rights, and the sort of where you slot yourself in the seasonal calendar so that it kind of makes sense for everyone.
I think the other sort of symbolic thing going on here is the fact that it's in the World Cup stadium. So now when you think about the World Cup, yes, it may have been massively expensive and we didn't maybe get out as much as we spent on it. And all those economic arguments aside, it was psychologically, it kind of showed what South Africa could sort of do.
It's that symbolism, that societal symbolism.
Exactly. There was a lot of good feeling and a lot of it was much higher quality in some ways than, for example, Brazil's Olympics.
Yeah.
You know, Brazil holds its Olympics and it's just the whole program is filled with problems to the extent that some athletes don't even go.
Yeah.
We didn't have that problem. We achieved great things for a short amount of time.
It was relatively safe. It was a huge celebration. It was a lot of fun.
A month where South Africans could see the potential of their country.
Yeah.
And then it disappeared again.
And then you don't see it. And so it's really good to remember that, you know, if we had for the last decade, instead of growing at less than the rate of population growth, we'd been growing at 5%, or even better, growing like Ethiopia or India, you know, then we would be having, then the $1 million golf tournament wouldn't have moved from Houghton to Sun City to be replaced by partly a sort of estate on the Houghton golf course, whose biggest advertisement for its multi-million rand flats was, guys, no load shedding here because we have a personal generator. Instead, you'd be having Bill Gates and Tiger Woods and all the big names coming to play in Houghton and go party in Norwood or Soweto, and and just and bring the luster, and with the luster comes a sense of trust, and with the sense of trust comes excitement about new economic opportunities, and with that comes an increase in jobs, and with that you get the virtual cycle of yet more money to go into these kinds of things. And we really just could be, you know, if you the Australian Open turning into a Grand Slam is a fairly recent event on the sort of broader tennis time frame. And I've got to say, Australia does not have that much latent social cachet. It is...
It's also a very long flight for anyone who wants
to get there. It's really far away. It wasn't that hip. And it managed to overcome the obstacles of being the sort of prisoner colony, the very worst of the colonies of the United Kingdom, because they sent its prisoners there because they had literally bounties on Aboriginals' heads, because they were an extremely nasty, racist, brutal country, much like us, but without the sort of then a beautiful Mandela turnaround. It was just, and it's, you know, aside from the Sydney Opera House, like culturally very dry, a lot of the art that it makes about itself is about precisely how dry and rustic and uncouth so much of Australian life is. But they push through it, and they show that you can turn like what looks like a losing formula into a real win if you bargain hard, if you are
if you offer tenacious something,
and you keep working at it, and and really what it comes down to is that there are lots of people in the world who've, by hook or by crook, got lots of money, and they want to go and entertain themselves and be seen entertaining themselves, and you create a platform from that. And and the winners are the ordinary citizens selling ice creams and changing the bath towels in the 5-star hotels that they're going to. You know, that really does make a difference to a lot of people's lives. And it's a difference that we fail to make here.
And
a little bit in our golf, a little bit in our tennis, and but a little bit in so many
this
bigger ways.
Missed opportunity you speak of. The sad thing is, in the year 2020, 10 years after the World Cup, South Africa is increasingly irrelevant. Socially, economically, culturally. Increasingly, it is the country that could have been.
Yeah.
It's the country that was the future once. And if we had the wherewithal and the presence of mind to have cashed those chips in the early 2000s, even with the, you know, residual glow of the 2010 World Cup, then it really could have created something of a societal symbol to be proud of, to unite around, and to pique the interest of people who have money to spend.
Mm. Yeah. And if you look at the countries that do it right, you get the Soccer World Cup, then after that you get the Olympics, then after that you get the Rugby World Cup, so that those stadiums keep...
Yeah. Japan, South Korea are very good examples of exactly this. Mm.
And then, and once you've done that, once you've got that 7-year like boost, the real winning ticket is to get a whole bunch of new tourists that have come. If someone's visited your country 4 times in like 7 years, they are so much more likely to have found local connections, both in terms of business and in terms of like where they really like to go, that then becomes their regular holiday destination. Mm. That's how you make tourism work.
So so let's move on from what could have been to what is. Mm. Herman, tell us about investment firms and EWC.
Well, here they are. We've spent the last couple of weeks strategically, you know, what we've realized is that the EWC debate is sometimes lost in abstraction. It's this idea of a document that people consider important, changing words. What
people think it's only going to affect farmers.
Yes, and it's always
someone else.
So it's either practical and it's farmers, or it's this like almost theological thing. Do you believe in the Constitution? Do you believe in human rights? Do you believe in protecting the Bill of Rights?
Heresy. And what we've over the past few weeks done, I think, very successfully, the IRR here, is we've targeted the banks. We've asked them, right, make this real for us. We're going to ask you a question. What are you going to do to protect your to protect the clients who trust you with their money? We went after agricultural business to say, right, get off this fence that you've been sitting on for a while. We went after insurance companies asking, now, are you willing to insure your clients against government theft? I mean, you insure them against usual theft. Will you be willing to go broader than that? And then this week, we're going to go after the investment funds, the investment managers, to essentially ask them, you want South Africans to trust you with their assets, with their savings, with their pensions. What are you going to do? What are you doing to protect them, to advise them on the risk they face. So the whole idea is to take EWC away from the abstract and take it to your pocketbook, your kitchen, where you actually have to make spending decisions. And this week, we're going to start applying that final layer of pressure.
Exactly, because the history of South Africa is big labor, big business, and big government all working together to sort of mess around ordinary South Africans. Mm. And we don't want
When it goes wrong,
we don't want to see a situation where these companies are allowed to sit on the fence about their an attack on the fundamental human rights of all South Africans.
And Nick, you and I spoke about this. The reason for them sitting on the fence, I mean, there's a whole range of it. I mean, they could be naive ostriches.
Some of them fear the government.
Some of them are just naive and don't care. Some of them are actively thinking that they could make a buck out of this economic restructuring. And it's whatever the reason is for sitting on the fence, South Africans, ordinary South Africans who have the power of the wallet, should take that power and understand that they have
demand some better features from our companies.
Yes.
Yeah. And you got to remember, so it's tempting, I think, as much as we knock on big business in this country generally, and the IRR does not usually do that.
Yeah.
There's this kind of, there's the Zonda thing, this Zulu word for envy. English metaphor is cutting down the tall poppies. Mm. If a company does really well, then somehow it must be wrong. There's that kind of attitude. The flip side of that is a kind of naive belief that if a business is big enough, its interests must lie in the healthy and sustainable economic growth of the country. Mm. Because the more money there is, the more customers there are, the more money you stand to make.
But that's definitely not always true.
It's true in the long run, but we don't live in the long run.
We don't all invest. When you're the CEO of a company, you don't always sit around for the long run.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You might be in it for the day to day. So just as a blatantly obvious kind of example, power production in this country has flatlined over the last 10 years. Okay, it's crazy. The economy is to continue to tick up a little bit. The population's continue to tick up quite a lot. And yet,
ESCOM personnel has doubled in numbers.
Yeah, and yet ESCOM produces about as much power, viable power, as it did a decade ago. Mm. Okay, so that sounds like a really losing proposition. If you're a coal supplier, if you're a diesel supplier, if you're a construction worker, if you're an employer, that might sound like, well,
you're a generator salesman.
Never mind the generator salesman. I'm saying if you're in the main business of ESCOM power supply, you've got to think, or being in that value chain, you've got to think like 10 years ago, if you're going to look at a situation where production is going to flatline for the next decade, like whatever's leading to that, that's bad. We need to undo that because that means we've got less chance to make profit. And it's true the overall pie has relatively shrunk, but individual players have had their slice of the pie balloon because the reason it shrunk is precisely that they ballooned their own prices, right? If you're a diesel provider and you can by hook or by crook allow or incentivize or just get along with the government running its system so badly that they have to be firing their plants on diesel instead of coal a lot of the time, hey, you're going to do it because you're going to make a lot of money. Yep. If you're a coal supplier who can sell the coal at twice the price because you've got a BEE deal that sort of somehow rinses the coal from its original source, then you're going to do that. Sure, it'll shrink the market, but it's going to boost your slice of it. So the thing to really watch out for, besides the sort of ideological naivete, or the naivete that goes with ideological commitments, is major corporates that are willing to bet on the pie shrinking, but their own particular slice of it grow.
Yeah.
So, Herman, what should everyone listening, ordinary South Africans, think about this? What can they do?
Well, I think the make it real for yourself. Understand that this is not just some abstract thing, and it's not a holy debate between two denominations of religion. This is a decision that will affect the assets you have. It will affect the value of your home. It will affect the ability of your business to claim certain assets as part of its security portfolio.
It will affect the likelihood of your children finding work.
And if we break it down in the pressure campaigns we've had, then it'll affect your bond payment. Will the bank, and the answer seems to be yes, but the question is, will the banks expect you to pay off debt on property that has been expropriated? The answer is probably yes. That'll affect you. The second one is, will your insurer be willing to protect you against such a significant risk? You must ask them this. And a note to the insurance companies, if I lose my house this month, I'm not paying my insurance premium next month. That's your revenue. That's your income going down the drain. Be aware of that. And then we've got this idea of the investment firms and that basically manage the assets and the savings and the wealth hopes of millions and millions of South Africans. It's not good enough to think that, oh, it'll all work out in the end. Whenever those kind of things happen, it's because people, whenever things work out, it's because people actually took action. Yeah. Apartheid didn't fall apart. It was dismantled, and it was dismantled rather slowly, but people actually stepped up to where
civil society, business, people, labor, political parties, all of them came together and dismantled the thing.
Exactly. And this idea, I think, that the ANC has sold very well is that it was responsible. No one else did anything. It was responsible, and somehow that creates this idea that, oh, well, it all worked out. It all worked out in the end. And now we can look at a similar thing and think, oh, it will all work out in the end. But what we forget is exactly as you say, the role players that were actually involved in saving us from a terrible, terrible rock bottom. And South Africans need to know this. And this isn't fear-mongering. This isn't that, oh, they're going to burn your house down. This is policy. It's in black and white. The rules that they are making is going to change the game. Believe them when they say that.
Yeah, and if I can add a proviso about this sort of avoiding the temptation to think that this is some fundamental theological debate. When President Ramaphosa became the leader of the ANC, it was December 18th, 2017. It was 2 days later on December 20th that he announced, quote, unanimous support amongst the ANC for EWC. And in those 2 days, I think a lot of euphoria went to, oh, Lord, amongst those who carefully follow the politics. December 20th, a lot of people are on holiday. Okay, but he left one ray of hope around, and he said, "We're only going to do this in such a way, and if it does not undermine the economy, food security, and so on."
Mm.
Now you don't have to. Okay, so there's two options. One option is take him at his word. If you're a Ramaphosa fan, if you think he's a really good guy who's got his hands tied behind his back, that is an open invitation for you to make your voice heard, to say this can EWC cannot be done in a way that does not undermine the economy, therefore we cannot do EWC. Mm. That is working together with him. If he was serious in making that problem, and you're a serious Ramaphosa fan, if you seriously believe that the guy who helped negotiate the end of apartheid and worked hard in the unions and so on is still the hero that he once was, then be the hero that he needs you to be and make your voice heard to say there is no way to do EWC without undermining the economy, which you promised you would not do. On the flip side, if you're a Ramaphosa opponent, then oppose him seriously. Don't – I think there's a – very apathy, or one sees this in some other countries in the former Soviet Union, where people have kind of completely given up on the thought that politics can ever be for real. Don't be so aloof and so above the whole game that you think there's no change to be had, there's no point to be made by making your voice heard. If you look throughout even our recent history, when Jacob Zuma fired Nene, the finance minister, and appointed Des van Rooyen, pressure brought Pravin Gordhan back. Now, Pravin Gordhan was better than Des van Rooyen. When Jacob Zuma fired Pravin Gordhan, people hit the streets and said, no, enough of that. If we're going to have a communist, can we at least have an honest communist with his hands on the fiscus purse? And think about how small the difference was between Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma winning and Cyril Ramaphosa winning. Those, I feel like every voice kind of made a, every little bit of impact was necessary in order to tip us over the edge from that worst case kind of scenario. Pressure makes a difference. And every bit of pressure is needed right now in the resistance, because we're facing an overwhelming force of apathy and complacency to wipe out the country's property rights.
A lost word, someone?
Our boss always has this wonderful quote about the Vietnam War not being lost in the jungles of the Vietnam, but in the living rooms of middle America. That's where we need to win this debate. You can't sit in your living room and think this will never happen to me, because then the war is already lost.
And if you would like to help the IRR apply pressure and continue funding our work, our activism, our research, please join us, become a friend, SMS your name to 32823 or go to the website and click join us. SMSs cost R1. Terms and conditions apply. Thank you very much for listening to The Daily Friend. Please remember to share us, like us, subscribe to us, all that kind of good stuff. And we'll catch you on the Wednesday edition. Thanks for listening.